Hello and welcome to Prehistory, the Archaeology of the Ancient Near East, with me, Jane. Last time we started off our look at the pottery, or rather the ceramic Neolithic, in Anatolia, where the westward expansion of farming societies resumed after a long hiatus, and regionally distinct groups developed over the 7th millennium BCE in central and western Anatolia. This time, I want to continue looking at the way that societies changed over the pottery Neolithic, moving south to have a look at the pottery Neolithic of the Levant. The Levant is a handy way to describe the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. From the point of view of the Near East, this is the western border for the region, apart from the bulge of Asia Minor to the north of the Levant. In previous episodes, we've mostly looked at the Levant as a single thing, although admittedly with some variation in the types of stone tools and other goodies turning up from time to time between the northern and the southern ends of this coast. As we move into the Pottery Neolithic, we're starting to talk about the Levant more formally as two Levants, one northern and one southern. These are essentially divided by the southern margins of the Lebanon Mountains, although in terms of the way that we talk about them, they're often more specifically divided up by modern countries. The southern Levant isn't just the strip of land closest to the coast of the Mediterranean, but includes essentially the whole area of what is now Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. To the north, unsurprisingly, we have the northern Levant, made up by modern-day Lebanon, as well as the southwestern parts of Syria and the very southeastern coastal part of Turkey. As we start looking at the Pottery Neolithic, these divisions show up as more than just arbitrary lines made up from modern countries. But it is also worth keeping in mind that some modern political reasons have occasionally made it tricky for archaeologists to work back and forth between the countries of the Levant. And people working in the northern Levant sometimes find it difficult to go and do research in the southern Levant, and the same is true in the reverse. There are some things about life in the Levant after about 7,000 Cal BCE that are pretty much the same all over. One of these is how people fed themselves. In both the northern and the southern Levant, we see a decrease in the proportion of food that comes from wild resources. This is especially clear in the case of animals, where there is a pretty well-documented decrease in hunting that takes place over the course of the pre-pottery Neolithic, especially at its later stages. During the pottery Neolithic, most of the food that people ate would have been coming from domestic plants and animals that they themselves produced, rather than being mostly hunted or collected in the wild, or there being a mix of food grown at home and wild food collected away from the village. This has often been argued as a sign that people had sort of completed the domestication process, and that there wasn't as much need to go hunting or collecting wild foods because people were now able to produce pretty much everything that they needed. Another side of this argument is that people may have stopped wanting to spend as much time away from their village, and instead were more focused on making sure that their own fields and animals were well taken care of. Apart from this, though, life in the Levant after about 7,000 Cal BCE can be divided up between the northern and the southern part. There are also differences about how much we know about this first stage of the Pottery Neolithic between the north and south of the Levant. In the northern Levant, it's still not entirely clear how the distribution of settlements changed at the end of the pre-Pottery Neolithic and into the beginning of the Pottery Neolithic. There has been some suggestion that settlements became smaller and more spread out, similar to what we saw in central Anatolia. But at the moment, there's not exactly enough evidence from excavated settlements of the 7th millennium to be entirely sure one way or the other. While there haven't been all that many northern Levantine Pottery Neolithic, or really even all that many northern Levantine pre-Pottery Neolithic settlements that have had a lot of excavation, the ones that we have found and had a good look at are more or less enough for us to have a general idea of how big they were or how they were laid out. And the ones that we do have do seem to have been mostly small villages, under about 5 hectares and mostly about 1 or 2 hectares. The houses inside of these villages were often distributed in a series of groups, a bit like the neighborhoods of the villages in central Anatolia, but without the houses packed anywhere near so closely together. These houses were often grouped together around a section of street, or a wider area more like a plaza or a village square. Pottery Neolithic villages have either one or several of these groups of houses dotted around, rather than everyone living in a single larger house group. These houses were rectangular, with stone foundations and walls made out of either mud brick or of rammed earth called pisé, also not too different to what we saw in the pre-pottery Neolithic nearby in northern Mesopotamia. Inside of the houses, they were finished off with lime plaster on the floors and walls. In some villages, all of these houses are one room, and in others, some of the houses have one room, and some had more small rooms built up inside, either used as extra living space or for storage. In other villages, houses with multiple rooms were more common. We also saw internal rooms and houses in the pre-pottery Neolithic, but as we move through the pottery Neolithic, we have a repeating pattern of groups of houses clustered together with space set out between them. Over time, these houses also seem to get a little bigger, and more of them often have internal rooms or storage spaces, and also have more of these rooms on average. Later on, after say about 6700 or 6600 Cal BCE, we also occasionally have some houses with walled open courtyards set to one side. Either something that could be used for extra storage away from the neighbors, or where your daily activities could have been done outside, but in a bit more privacy than you would have gotten between the houses or in the open spaces between the clusters of houses. Aside from a more private and local layout in the villages, the people living in Pottery Neolithic communities in the Northern Levant had something else different from those in the pre-Pottery Neolithic. Yeah, again, this is pottery. Just like in Anatolia, it's not a big surprise, as this is the name of the period, so it kind of gives it away. Like in Anatolia, pottery in the Northern Levant turns up really early, from about 7000 Cal BCE. Like in Anatolia, pottery seems not to have been all that common when it first appeared, although unlike in Anatolia, it becomes a normal part of daily life not long after 7000 Cal BCE, after maybe 100 years or so, rather than after 500 years. In the Northern Levant, the common type of pottery that we see is generally called dark-faced burnished ware. In the very earliest Pottery Neolithic, up to say 6700 or 6600 Cal BCE, there are other types of pottery that are also common, but which more or less go out of fashion afterwards. What these are called varies depending on which valley or even which cluster of sites you're looking at, as the pottery type tends to be named differently by different archaeologists working on different sites. Some of the pottery is pretty similar, and some are more different. And generally, we can think of this earliest pottery as something that had a lot more local variation before people started to follow a more general regional pottery fashion later on. Depending on where you're looking, these earliest pots might be called kirkware, sandyware, or light-faced burnished ware. In other words, lighter colored pots of various names were more common from about 7000 Cal BCE, but after about 6600 Cal BCE, the fashion changed towards darker colored pottery. Although these still were not the only types that people used, and a variety of local lighter-colored or coarser-type pottery turns up at sites across the region. The similarity of dark-faced burnished ware, in that it pops up across sites all over most of the Northern Levant, means that this has tended to get a bit more attention. Unfortunately, having this handy term for early Pottery Neolithic pots in the Northern Levant can mean that some archaeologists include anything that's fairly dark in color and a bit shiny as dark-faced burnished ware. And this can hide what's actually a lot of variation between sites in the shapes of the pottery and the ways that they're made. The fairly basic shapes of these pots also hide some of this variation, as dark-faced burnished ware tends to be mostly bowls or small jars, including jars with low necks, with the necks turning up more and more after about 6700 or 6600 Cal BCE. As with the pots of Anatolia, they tend to be reasonably small, not necessarily any bigger than, say, a big soup bowl or a saucepan. So they were probably not a part of a big change in the way that food was being stored. Overall, they also seem to have been fired at fairly low temperatures, somewhere below about 750 degrees Celsius. And the dark color seems to have been intentionally done as a way that the pots were fired, and wasn't just an accident. Generally, these pots were also mineral tempered, as well as the various lighter colored early types. The surfaces could also be decorated, sometimes with little marks cut into them, or with little fingernail marks pushed into the clay, or with extra bands of clay added around the outside, or with marks from cords or similar textiles wrapped around the outside to leave the impressions. Other, more coarse types of pottery turn up at sites as well, which are sometimes mineral tempered and sometimes plant tempered, depending on the site. By the end of this early stage of the Pottery Neolithic, so from around 6000 Cal BCE, a division of the dark-faced burnished ware as the sort of fine or fancy ware, and what we call coarse ware as the coarse or basic ware, seems to have become pretty fixed. In most northern parts of the Northern Levant, around the border between modern-day Turkey and Syria, dark-faced burnished ware seems to have become pretty rare, and most of the pottery that was used was the coarse type. Here, the sites mostly have a local type of pottery that's called pinkish gritty ware, which, like the more southern coarse ware, is a light-colored pottery with a mineral temper. There is also an increase in the types of pottery that we find at sites in this area, like at Yumuk Tepe, where we start to see a lot more functionally specific types of pottery, like separate cooking and serving bowls, and separate shapes of pots for other specific uses, like storing dry foods or carrying water. In more southern parts, like in the Rouge Basin, The proportions of fine and coarse pots, or of dark-faced burnouseware and coarseware, look to be more even all the way through to the end of the 7th millennium. In the northern Levant, elongated projectile points were more common in the pre-pottery Neolithic. But in the pottery Neolithic, the fashions changed, and these projectile points got shorter. Between the later parts of the pre-pottery Neolithic and into the earlier part of the pottery Neolithic, people in the northern Levant were doing less hunting, and getting most of their meat and other animal products from domestic animals. Some archaeologists have suggested that this shrinking of the projectile points was due to this reduction in hunting. However, as the pottery Neolithic went on, these projectile points started to get bigger again. Some recent studies have suggested that this might have been because arrowheads, and the use of these points mostly for bows and arrows, started to become less common, and instead the projectile points were used more for throwing spears and darts. It has been suggested that this might relate either to a fashion for the carrying and display of weapons like spears, or that this was due to an increase in the use of spears more practically, as weapons, rather than specifically only as hunting tools. While we don't necessarily have a lot of evidence for warfare in this period, this doesn't mean that it didn't happen. Archaeologically, the best evidence that we have for warfare is finding skeletons with projectile points stuck in their bones, or with other really big injuries, settlements that were destroyed in some sort of distinctive way, such as being burned to the ground, or with an increase in weapons. Of course, a lot of this evidence would assume that fights were taking place on a large scale inside the settlements and not outside them, and also that people were routinely getting lucky and managing to sink an arrow or a stone-tipped spear into a person hard enough to drive it into the bone where it couldn't be pulled free. If we're looking at the sorts of materials that weapons of this time would have been made from, then the parts that would have preserved over the millennia would really mostly have been these stone projectile points. Although these stone points would not necessarily be all that different, regardless of whether they were used for hunting, for protection from dangerous wild animals, or for fighting with other people. This means both that there may have been an increase in people fighting one another during the pottery Neolithic in the northern Levant, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that this would have been the first time that this happened. If we think of the capacity for hunting weapons to also function as people-killing weapons, we need to remember that people could have been fighting one another for thousands or tens of thousands of years before this as well. It's more the drop of evidence that we have for hunting in the pottery Neolithic that makes it more noticeable that what we would traditionally think of as only hunting weapons are still not only fairly common, but are also getting bigger again. These projectile points also aren't just limited to stone. Projectile points made out of bone are pretty rare, but some of these do turn up at sites, such as the few that were made and found in the excavations at the site of Shear. These bone projectile points are really rare, and when we do find them, they're made to mimic the shape of the stone projectile points. Apart from the projectile points, we see some changes to stone tools in the way that they're made, but other parts of the technology also continues on from what we saw in the pre-pottery Neolithic. One example of things that don't really change is the continued use of naviform core and blade technology throughout at least the first few centuries of the pottery Neolithic. While these cores are still around, though, they're not the only way that stone tools were made. New approaches, like using pressure flaking and single platform cores, also turn up in the northern Levant in the early pottery Neolithic. Or, to put it another way, there are changes in the way that stone tools are made, such as the new technologies of production, like pressure flaking, that we saw in Anatolia, but people didn't necessarily give up their old ways of making stone tools just because there were new trends. Instead, we have a mixing of old and new approaches, either by different people or by the same person using both methods, depending on what they felt like making that day. The change from the pre-pottery Neolithic to the pottery Neolithic in the southern Levant was not quite as smooth as what we've seen in Anatolia or in the northern Levant. As we talked about in episode 16, this is the part of the Near East that gave us the idea of a pre-pottery Neolithic collapse. From about 7000 Cal BCE, we don't see the introduction of pottery or otherwise more gradual changes to societies. In the southern Levant, 7000 Cal BCE is not the start of the pottery Neolithic, but instead it's the beginning of a final stage of the pre-pottery Neolithic, called the PPNC. It's here in the PPNC that the old megasites were either abandoned or just have a much smaller group of people living in them. The trade around the Near East in imported goodies like obsidian also drops off a lot. This happens in other parts of the Near East, but it's most noticeable in the southern Levant because this is so much farther from things like obsidian sources of Anatolia. The northern Levant seems to lose a lot of its obsidian as well, but we don't have quite as many big excavations of PPNB sites from the northern Levant, so it's a little bit harder to figure out just how much obsidian trade they had, And also if there's any evidence that the megasites were getting the lion's share of traded goodies, like we saw in the Southern Levant. When people moved away from the megasites in the Southern Levant after about 7,000 Cal BCE, they settled mostly into smaller villages dotted around the landscape. Many of these were either occupied for a fairly short period, maybe a few generations or a few centuries, and then it became the flat sites that I talked about last time, which are harder to find. Other villages had people continuing to live in them from the PBNC into the Pottery Neolithic and even later. This means that some of these villages became part of the tells that I talked about last time also. Each of these has its problems, as flat sites can be hard to find, and the PBNC levels of tell sites are often some of the earliest, if not the earliest, occupations of the villages that grew into tells, and therefore they're on the bottom, and hard to get to, except in small areas at the bottom of a deep excavation. Some of these PBNC villages probably are still lurking at the bottom of the archaeological sites that we already know about, but which have deep deposits of material from later time periods that no one's willing to excavate, and thereby destroy, in order to dig down just to get to the bottom of the site. Like I said before, this is a common problem in archaeology. We don't know where all of the old settlements were from any time period, so we have to do the best at the ones that we do know about and try to learn as much as possible from what we've got. And yes, this means that there are, inevitably, gaps in what we know, and that leads to arguments about how life changed over time, especially in time periods that are a little bit more murky. The PBNC is one of these fairly murky periods. The best excavated area that we've traditionally had from a PBNC village was the site of Ain Ghazal in what's now Jordan. This was one of the megasites from the PBNB, and people continued to live at Ain Ghazal afterwards, although the population shrank down to more of a normal village size. Ain Ghazal continued to be occupied throughout the Pottery Neolithic as well, but it doesn't have thousands of years of settlement on top of this, so it's been a lot easier to expose pretty good-sized areas of the old Pottery Neolithic villages, as well as the ones from the PBNC underneath. It also means that we have a whole sequence of life from the PBNB through the PBNC and into the Pottery Neolithic. More recent excavations in more northern parts of the Southern Levant, at the site of Baisamoun, have found another continuously occupied sequence from the later part of the PBNB throughout the PBNC. And a similar long sequence has also been found in the middle of the Southern Levant at the site of Mozza, as well as at a couple of other sites. Although these excavations were either very recent or they're still ongoing, so a lot of what's been found is either still being studied or just hasn't yet been published. What a lot of these more recent excavations give us is a slightly better idea of how life changed in the Southern Levant at the end of the pre-Pottery Neolithic, or rather, at the end of the PBNB and over the so-called collapse of the PBNC. What we see at the end of the PBNB is a combination of small and large villages, including a few of the large megasites, made up of rectangular houses with internal rooms. Stone tools were mostly made out of local flints, but enough obsidian trickled in from Anatolia that a noticeable proportion of the tools were made out of this as well. People mostly lived from growing their own domesticated plants and herding domesticated livestock, mainly sheep and goats, although there is a bit of evidence to suggest that they may also have had domesticated pigs and even cattle by this point. Neither of these animals turn up in really big numbers at sites, so it can be a bit hard to tell if they're wild or domestic. Although in the Southern Levant, as we move into the PBNC, we do start to find more of these animals at sites, suggesting that they might have been part of the domestic herded animals. You may remember from episode 12 when we talked about animal domestication that the main ways of identifying animals as being domesticated is that they turn up out of place, they get smaller, or they get killed and eaten in a particular way. That is, people mostly start to eat the excess boys when they're still pretty young, and before they grow up and start causing trouble amongst themselves, or with the girls, and they leave most of the girl animals to grow up and have a few sets of babies before they go on the dinner menu. Well, when you have only a few cattle or pigs at a site, in an area where wild cattle and boar already turn up, then you're left with comparing the size and the age distribution of the animals that you found. When most of these animals are found mostly as small broken pieces, then there might not be enough whole bits to measure and compare with the earlier wild animals, or enough bits which can give you information about how old the animal was when somebody killed and ate it, let alone whether it was male or female. So it gets complicated figuring out exactly when cattle and pigs were domesticated anywhere, let alone when they started turning up at farming villages in the Southern Levant, or also if they were domesticated in only one place or in many places at different times. So of course, we argue about when and where and how many times cattle and pigs got domesticated. We do this for sheep and goats too, and for most of the plants, but we tend to know a bit more about these, so actually there are slightly fewer arguments. Slightly. Anyway, we have farming villages across the southern Levant, which by the end of the PPNB are mostly growing their own food. People do still go hunting and collect plants in the wild, both cereals like barley and wheat, but also fruits, nuts, and other plants. Foraging may be a bit fashionable these days in some parts of the world, but it really isn't new, and some level of collecting wild plants has always happened. And it also happened at the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic, even if it wasn't really a big portion of people's daily food. I already said that hunting and wild plant gathering dropped off a lot at the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic in the northern Levant, and that this also happened in the southern Levant. But here it was actually a little bit more complicated. In the far south and east of the southern Levant, in some of the areas where we now have deserts, it was already pretty dry around 7000 Cal BCE. People still lived here, though, and not always in the same sorts of farming villages that we see in the rest of the southern Levant. Domestic sheep and goats turn up here even in the dry parts, but other domestic animals, that is, if they were domesticated already, either couldn't manage or maybe weren't worth the effort of keeping in most places. Some people grew crops, with maybe a bit or maybe a lot of gathering of wild plants, and some didn't seem to bother all that much with growing crops in the drier areas and instead lived off of wild plants and their domesticated animals, while also hunting animals like deer and gazelle, in order to add a little bit more variety to the dinner menu. For most of the area of the southern Levant, though, most of what people ate after about 7000 Cal BCE was grown or raised at home. Apart from these drier parts of the southern Levant, though, we had these PPNB farming villages. And from about 7000 Cal BCE, we stopped having these PPNB farming villages. The population collapsed, people ran screaming in the street, fire rained down from the sky, the rivers spilled their banks and flooded the fields, Vikings descended to sack the towns, and Godzilla rose from the sea to chase screaming people across the fields. Okay, no, obviously Godzilla and the Vikings never actually happened. In fact, none of this actually happened, although it does make a nice story. I said before in episode 16 that for a long time we didn't have all that much information about what happened in the southern Levant for a few hundred years after about 7000 Cal BCE, so we thought that the end of the PPNB was a collapse. I mentioned the people living in the drier parts of the southern Levant because that was actually an argument that was made about what happened to people at the end of the PPNB, that it got really dry and that people mostly abandoned the old megasites and a lot of the villages and instead just moved around the landscape with their herds. This doesn't really seem to have been the case. There were people in some parts of the southern Levant who hunted, gathered, and herded, but most people just kept living in farming villages, if maybe not in megasites and maybe in slightly different parts of the same landscapes. Most of these villages were small, like the ones in Anatolia and the ones in the northern Levant, and like these, they were either not lived in for more than a few centuries and therefore became the hard-to-find flat sites, or they were lived in for a long time and became the bottom parts of tell sites. Some of them, though, like Engazal, Baisamun, and Motza, were lived in all through the PPNB, the PPNC, and at least part of the Pottery Neolithic, and so became tell sites with Neolithic near the top of the hill, which is easier for us to excavate a big area and have a good idea of what life was like. What life was like in the southern Levant after 7000 Cal BCE was farming villages. People continued to live in rectangular houses, mostly made out of one big room, but sometimes divided into more rooms on the inside. Some of these were arranged in a cluster around a central courtyard. Over the course of the PPNC, the houses tended to get a little smaller and more often had internal rooms. People in the PPNC continued to make stone tools. Chipstone tools, which used to be made most popularly with the naviform cores and blades, started to see new fashions for the manufacture and use of pressure flaking and denticulated retouch. This is the pressure flaking of tiny pieces off of the side of the blade or another tool in order to give it a serrated or toothy appearance, hence denticulated. There wasn't a complete changeover to this new way of making stone tools, though. And at some sites like Baisamun, we see several different ways of making stone tools, with both the older PPNB and the newer methods being used at the same time. At other sites, people moved over to the new fashion for making tools a bit faster. I mentioned also that the end of the PPNB was the time when the obsidian trade out of eastern Anatolia and through the northern and the southern Levant mostly collapsed. This is true, although maybe not as big of a deal as I have previously led you to believe. Obsidian from sources in the very eastern parts of Anatolia or the southern Caucasus did stop traveling south across the Levant. However, obsidian was still making its way south, all the way through both the northern and the southern Levant, except now this was mostly coming from obsidian sources in Cappadocia, farther to the west. There is perhaps not as much obsidian making its way south, but we can't exactly think of the southern Levant as being completely cut off either. So it wasn't maybe so much of a collapse as a shift. although the southern Levant maybe wasn't exactly flooded with obsidian. Some of the other things that we used to see traded around the PPNB are also still there, like shell jewelry and beads. These still come from both the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, and they commonly traveled across sites of the region, often hundreds of kilometers or hundreds of miles from the seas where they were originally collected. One thing that does seem to change in the southern Levant is where the dead people went, or rather, where people preferred to bury their relatives. We talked about it being reasonably common in the PPNB to bury at least some people under the floors of houses, or in other parts of the village, and in some cases to keep the skulls and make them part of the family, as it were, or at least on display in the house or in a communal building. Well, in some sites we do still get people buried under the floors in the early part of the PPNC, and some skulls covered in plaster and kept back with the living. But this practice seems to go out of fashion over the course of the PPNC, and we stop finding dead people after about 6600 to 6500 Cal BCE, so presumably they were starting to get buried somewhere else, either on the edge of the village or outside it, or they were cremated. In other words, we generally stop finding them. Sometimes skeletons do turn up from the early part of the PPNC, like at Baisemun, where they found several, including some cremations. I'm sorry if you're a bit squeamish, but actually finding cremations isn't that much more difficult than finding a burial, as in the past, cremations were, let's say, less efficient than the modern ones, and not everything was burned all the way to ash. Cremation is something that we actually don't see in the PPNB, and it seems to be something new in the PPNC, at least in the southern Levant. These burials, and the cremations, from Baisemun have been studied by specialists. And curiously, their teeth don't seem to have been as good as the ones that we find from people of the PPNB. For a start, they have more cavities in their teeth. This is something that we tend to associate with eating more soft and sugary foods, such as more grains and less in the way of tooth-scrubbing starchy vegetables. So it could relate to people doing less collecting and eating of wild plants. The teeth of the people that we found at Baisemun also have more of something that's called linear enamel hypoplasia. This has to do with the way that teeth form. Teeth, my teeth, your teeth, all human teeth, and really all teeth, form inside of the jawbone as a bud. This bud slowly grows as a little lump of dentine, the soft part which is inside each tooth. And then the hard tooth enamel starts to form at the top of the tooth and then sort of runs down the dentine lump towards what will become the base of the tooth before the roots start to grow out of the base and push the tooth forward out of the bone and into place in the mouth. When someone is under a lot of stress, like when they're very ill or not getting enough food, this process of tooth development can get interrupted. The body becomes focused on its current problem, like fighting off a disease or trying to keep itself functioning without enough food, and the growth of the tooth stops. This means that the enamel running down the tooth bud pauses, and when it starts up again, it leaves a little line in the enamel that never goes away because enamel never changes once it forms. This means that if you look at a tooth really close up, you can see a horizontal line running across the surface of the tooth, which is what we call the linear enamel hypoplasia, which basically just means a horizontal groove in the enamel. Finding one of these grooves means two things: that something bad happened to the owner of the tooth when they were young and the tooth was forming, and that they survived whatever happened and lived long enough for the tooth to finish forming and presumably to erupt. As teeth form at different times in someone's life, finding someone that has several of these grooves means that they were either sick a lot or they spent several times not being able to get enough to eat. The people at Baisemun had these linear enamel hypoplasias. Not everyone, and not necessarily a lot of them, but the skeletons that we found tend to have more of them than we find in the people from the PPNB, meaning that the people that lived at Baisemun in the early part of the PPNC were either sick more often, or worse, than the people who were in the PPNB, or that they tended to have more trouble getting enough to eat. Now, it might be that the people living at Baisemun were particularly unlucky, or it could be that people in the early part of the PPNC in the southern Levant more generally had more diseases or less food than previously. This is a brand new study, and like I said, we don't have a huge number of PPNC sites, and people started putting their dead in places other than inside the village. So at the moment, we don't necessarily know how common it was to have this increase in the grooves on teeth. It is, however, a rare bit of evidence that things may possibly not have been all sunny and smelling of roses in the PPNC, although probably not the apocalyptic collapse that we used to think. Apart from these people who have some unhappy teeth, life in the southern Levant and the PPNC continued on not all that differently from life in the PPNB, just in smaller villages with houses maybe a bit more simple in design or grouped into mini neighborhoods or a bit of both. This redesign in how the houses were laid out is something that we also see continuing beyond the PPNC, and its first appearance here in the PPNC has gotten some attention. We've seen this sort of pattern before in Anatolia and in the Northern Levant, groups of houses together around a common area. These tiny little neighborhoods of a few houses are often seen as indicating a change from the organization of daily life, including such things as the production and storage of food, moving from the level of the whole village or a big part of the village to the level of a single family or an extended family or a couple of otherwise closely connected families. Pottery doesn't really turn up in the Southern Levant during the PPNC, but stone bowls and other stone vessels that we've seen here since the PPNA do continue to be used. Sometimes they're left plain, and sometimes they're painted with red rims or have other decorations. Towards the later part of the PPNC, a few potsherds do turn up on sites, although not necessarily enough of them for us to think of pottery as being a daily part of life even in these later stages of the PPNC. This changes at about 6600 or 6500 Kelby CE, as we move from the end of the PPNC into the early part of the Pottery Neolithic, which in many parts of the Southern Levant is called the Yarmoukian culture, which in some areas also seems later to turn into another culture called the Lodian or the Jericho Nine. When this change from the PPNC to the Pottery Neolithic happens in the Southern Levant is a little bit more complicated, as it doesn't seem to happen everywhere all at the same time. This means that the changeover from the PPNC to the early Pottery Neolithic isn't a specific date in the Southern Levant, or even a specific century. It's best to think of this as something a bit more variable, with some villages getting pottery and new trends in making stone tools or house design from about 6700 Kelby CE, with some not seeming to change until 6600 or 6500 or even a little bit later than that. It is a bit difficult to determine not just when exactly over how large of an area the Southern Levant this happened, mostly because the first stage of the Pottery Neolithic, the Yarmoukian, isn't exactly the same all over the Southern Levant. Some areas of the very north and south of the Southern Levant, as well as in the east, in central and eastern Jordan, aren't necessarily considered to have ever been part of the Yarmoukian culture. But this is something of an argument, mainly due to the fact that the Yarmoukian isn't necessarily just one thing. You may remember when we talked about the PPNB of northern Mesopotamia, and I talked about how there were different ideas about how we think of the PPNB in the Near East, either as one big interaction sphere across large parts of the Near East, or is a series of overlapping groups, which each did things a little bit differently from groups in the next valley or from those farther down the same river. We saw this with some differences, for example, in the way that people built their houses. Well, the Yarmoukian has a similar issue. Only a few of the sites that have been excavated from this stage of the Neolithic have had enough preserved houses to give us an idea of how these houses were built, what shapes they were, or how they were set out and around one another. In fact, up until about 40 years ago, there actually was an argument that this part of the early Pottery Neolithic was made up of roaming groups of herdsmen and farmers, largely because there wasn't enough evidence for preserved houses. And a few people even argued that early Pottery Neolithic farmers lived in pit houses because of this lack of evidence. Well, of course, as more sites were excavated and more information, quite literally, came to light, we now have several sites with preserved bits of village to give us an idea of how people organized themselves in the Yarmoukian. At a lot of these sites, it looks like houses were built with stone foundations, like we've seen before. We don't always know exactly how high up the wall the stone was used, and when people changed over to mud brick or packed earth, mostly because we just have the stone outlines of the foundations and a few fallen mud bricks or other wall material around the edges. This isn't all that unusual, especially in villages which had people living in them for a while afterwards, as areas where these houses were built would have been later leveled off for building another house or a street or just to tidy up the area. Where we do have at least the bases of the houses preserved, we can see that they're not all just rectangles. While some villages have rectangular houses, or at least some rectangular houses, others have houses that are more oval-shaped, or are circular, or have a rectangle but with one end rounded off for that nice organic look. Houses in the same village could all be the same shape, or come in all of these shapes at once. So it seems that house shape was more of a range of choices for each individual to pick from, rather than something that was divided up between villages in different regions. It was also not unusual for houses to have plastered floors, either from lime plaster or from a fine pale mud plaster. But this also wasn't compulsory, and some houses either seem to have done without or the plaster just hasn't survived. Some of the houses that we find have floors paved in stones set together to make a nice smooth cobbled surface, or crushed stones packed together to make a nice packed gravel floor. which was presumably more effort to make at the beginning, but would have saved having to replaster the floor every year or two. These houses could either be in one big room or be divided into internal rooms, and often had either a courtyard marked out next to each house, or two or more houses set around a communal courtyard. These clusters of houses, like we saw with the neighborhoods in Anatolia, and like what we also see in the northern Levant, suggest that people operated more at the family or extended family level, or between small groups or of a couple of extended families or friends. Instead of the entire village living and working together to plant their crops, tend to their animals, and take care of the other activities of day-to-day life, the setting out of these small groups of houses suggests that people were dividing themselves up not as a whole village, but into smaller groups, who may all live in the same village, but not necessarily sharing their activities and products between everyone. This is also suggested by the increased storage inside houses, and also by the few examples of private courtyards attached to houses. So this change in architecture and the layout of the villages is something that hints at everyday life moving from mostly the level of the village, like we saw in the pre-Pottery Neolithic, towards the level of life at the family or the smaller social group in the Pottery Neolithic. The Yarmoukian is also the time when we first start to see pottery turning up systematically across sites of the southern Levant. Just like everywhere else that we've talked about for this part of the Neolithic, it isn't really a big surprise, as the appearance of pottery is one of the big reasons why we consider this to be a new time period. Yarmoukian pottery comes in the same general range of shapes that we see for early pottery, mostly bowls and jars. These were made using a variety of techniques, including pulling out a single ball of clay directly into the desired shape, or rolling out different slabs of clay and pushing them together, or rolling out long coils of clay, piling them up, and then smoothing out the sides. The Yarmoukian also had its own special type of bowl, known as the pedestaled bowl, which means that it had a little stand built into the bottom, a bit like a large goblet with a very short and thick stem. Yarmoukian pottery varies in color, depending on the local color of the clay, but mostly it's red or reddish, which seems to have been the most fashionable and desired color, but we do also find it in gray, dark brown, or black. The outsides of the pots were often decorated with burnishing, so the polishing, or with bands of different colors, or with cut-in decorations like honeycombs or herringbone patterns. The change that we saw in Anatolia, where pottery seemed to have become a bigger part of daily life, that is, more potsherds were found in a given amount of excavation, also happens in the southern Levant, but it seems to happen at the end of this stage of the Pottery Neolithic, or after about 6,000 Cal BCE. The way that people buried their dead also changes in the Yarmoukian. Or rather, the changes that we saw coming in during the PPNC continue to change into the Yarmoukian. We do have people buried in the village once again, although this is still not necessarily very common. We have burials of little babies under the floors of houses, either in little stone-lined graves with stone covers or in jars. It may seem a bit odd to be burying the little ones in something not all that different from a big cooking pot, but this was more likely something more along the lines of a casket. If we remember that using pottery wasn't necessarily all that old of a development, and that pottery might have been a less common part of daily life, since it becomes more frequent later on, then this could be thought of as a fancy way of sending the unfortunate little one off into the afterlife in style. For most of the Pottery Neolithic in the southern Levant, we don't actually have that many burials. Jar burials of little ones are the most common type that we find, so it could be that older people were mostly buried somewhere else away from the village. The way that stone tools were made, which developed more variety during the PPNC, changes further into the Yarmoukian. The earlier emphasis on blades and the making of tools from blades broadens to incorporate a lot more emphasis on producing flakes. Blades don't completely go away, but they're no longer the really dominant type of tool or tool blank that people were using. Even for the blades where they're still being made and used, they're often a different shape and length than the ones that the people tended to make in the pre-Pottery Neolithic. We also see changes in the other uses of stone apart from chipped tools. Stone vessels don't go away just because people started to use pottery, and stone bowls were still used. In the Yarmoukian and later in the Lodian, these stone bowls tended to be thinner and more delicate, either as a fashion choice or to more closely mimic the pottery bowls that were also around. We also see more grinding stones in the Yarmoukian than we had in the PPNC. Why this might have happened is harder to figure out, as it could either be that these were, for whatever reason, tending to break more often, or it could be that more people were keeping their own grinding stones at home rather than sharing them out and around between different families in the village. We also get groundstone axes, which sometimes turn up on their own over part of the excavation of a village, and which sometimes are found as part of the burials of infants or other little ones, such as in the jar burials. Something else turns up in the Yarmoukian that we didn't really see that much before in the Southern Levant. One thing that the Yarmoukian is known for is its figurines. These can be made of ceramic or of stone, and can be of animals, but are often figurines of people. These figurines of people can be done to look lifelike, or they can be more abstract. Sometimes all we find are individual limbs, which either may have broken off of a figurine, but also may have been made just as an individual limb, with no effort made to make the rest of the body. For the figurines of whole people, there are two notably Yarmoukian things about the way that the human figurines were made. One is the way that the eyes were drawn, or rather cut into the figurines, which has been called the coffee bean or cowrie styles of eyes, or oval-shaped eyes with a little groove cut in through the middle. The other interesting thing is that some of these figurines show both male and female parts on the same figurine. We don't know why. Maybe it was a deity, or related to a myth, or hermaphrodites were considered to have been particularly special parts of society. Or maybe this was just a way to save time. In general, in the middle parts of the Southern Levant, where we have both the Yarmoukian and the Lodian cultures, it seems as though the Yarmoukian was the first stage of the Pottery Neolithic, and then some of the villages changed later into the Lodian culture type of villages, which are mainly distinguished on the basis of changes to the shape of the pottery, such as having new jars with longer necks, and less decoration on the outer surface of the pots. The most fashionable colors of these pots also changes. Red is still a fashionable color, but there's also more use of brown. The decoration of these pots, mostly painted or burnished, is also more commonly seen using light-colored backgrounds, which were painted on beforehand, in particular white, yellow, or pink. This painted decoration was often burnished also to make the pots smooth and shiny, rather than decoratively grooved like we saw in the Yarmoukian. There were also changes to the way that the stone tools were made, in particular more use of flakes. This includes some tools that used to be made from blades, like arrowheads and sickles, now being made from flakes. The Lodian in this way was much more distinct from the pre-pottery Neolithic than the tool making that we saw in the Yarmoukian, even though the previously much-loved blades never completely went away. Now, dividing out the Lodian as a different cultural group is a slightly tricky thing in the Southern Levant. I mentioned already that the Yarmoukian is kind of variable, like with the choice of shape for houses. This high level of variation in the Yarmoukian leads to a good number of arguments when we're talking about the early pottery Neolithic of the Southern Levant. Some archaeologists don't really think that there's enough change to justify calling the Lodian a completely separate culture, and others consider there to be more variation and argue for anything between one and three or more other cultural groups in the Southern Levant in the later part of the Yarmoukian, or in the last few centuries of the 7th millennium BCE. Generally, though, the balance is to see most of the villages as Yarmoukian, with some in the central and western part changing at the end of the early part of the Pottery Neolithic into the Lodian version. So between the northern and the southern Levant, we have two different sets of changes at the end of the pre-Pottery Neolithic B, or after 7000 Cal BCE. In both of these regions, we see people moving towards life mostly in small farming villages, with community life seeming to change over towards a focus on the interaction more at the level of the family or the family group, rather than across the whole village. Hunting animals and collecting wild plants becomes only a minor part of how people got their food in both of these regions. We also see pottery being adopted across villages and developing its own fashions and local styles through time. In both of these regions, we see changes to the way that people made stone tools, with some new techniques like pressure flaking making their way in the technological repertoire, but with a range of techniques being used, and the older methods not necessarily being thrown away as soon as the new techniques come in. What differs between the northern and the southern Levant mainly is the time over which these changes come in. In the southern Levant, we see the organization of villages changing first, several hundred years before new things like pottery really come into the picture. It's still not entirely clear why this happened, since the southern Levant was not exactly all that far away from the north, and other signs of general interaction with the northern Levant, like pressure flaking and the movement of obsidian, show us that the south was not exactly completely cut off at the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic B. The best explanation at the moment, although, of course, there are arguments, is that for whatever reason, pottery was not particularly desirable as a part of how people cooked, stored, or ate their food, at least not across the whole region. An alternative explanation is that the knowledge of how to make pottery took a while to filter across enough villages that it started to be common. Although that assumes that no one from the southern Levant saw pottery, or it being used or made, at all during the few hundred years of the PPNC. And it also means that we have to conveniently forget the early examples of pottery that we saw from the PPNB in the southern Levant, like at Kfar HaHoresh. What we see then at the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic is the development in the Levant of regional clusters of interaction, a lot like what we saw in Anatolia at the same time. We still have a lot more work to do to better understand this time period in the northern Levant, and the diversity of the Yarmukian in the southern Levant, so it's still difficult to tell if we have little subgroups within either the northern or the southern Levant, where people had their own local fashions and practices, like what we saw in western Anatolia and the Lakes region. Even if we're looking at cultural groups sharing ideas, techniques, and fashions across all of the northern Levant and all of the southern Levant, then what we are seeing here in the 7th millennium BCE is still similar to what we saw in Anatolia. At the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic, people moved onto a smaller scale. They shared fashions across smaller regional groups and organized themselves into small villages with social networks based more along the smaller level of the extended family. Next time, we'll have a look at life in Mesopotamia after the pre-pottery Neolithic to see if these changes to a smaller scale of life repeat in the land between two rivers. Thank you for listening to the Prehistory Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach me at prehistorypodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to see some of the pottery, houses, or stonework that I've talked about today, you can find these on the website at prehistorypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give the podcast a rating and a review on your platform of choice to help others find it. And come back and join us next time, when we will continue working our way through the pottery Neolithic of the Near East with a look at life in Mesopotamia.